afternoon, everyone. Can you hear me okay? Yeah. All right, well, you're not going to hear much from me. My name is Chris Breitmeyer, and I'm the president of Clatsop Community College. I know that because it says this on the script they gave me. I would like to welcome you to Astoria, to the Performing Arts Center of Clatsop Community College, First Center Wyden 2020 Clatsop Community Town Hall. Clatsop Community College is dedicated to inspiring learning, serving our students, and making this community the best it can be. I've been blessed to be here in this town for 3 years, and it's people like you that make me want to do more and better for this community. So thank you all for showing up. And now please stand as I lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance. Flag over here.
There we go.
I pledge allegiance
to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Now I'd like to introduce you to Clatsop Community Commissioner Mark Quila. He is a good guy. He pays his debts. I just got my $10 right before this meeting. So I thank you for that, Mark. And he's going to go over the format for asking questions.
Thank you very much. Is that all? No. Thank you very much, President Breitmeyer, for hosting this event. My name is Mark Quila, and I'm honored to represent District 1 on the Clatsop County Commission. I want to take a few seconds to thank Senator Wyden on behalf of the West Coast Trawl Fishing Fleet. He advocated for removing a $10 million burden on the fleet resulting from the ground fish buyback. That's a program almost 20 years old, all in the form of accrued interest on a loan that should have never been accrued. So thank you, Senator, for fighting for the rights, standing up for fishermen. So it's my duty to help assist with the Q&A today. And here's the process. Here's the ground rules for the Q&A today. Each person who wants to ask a question of the senator should have received a ticket when they came in the door. If you haven't got a ticket and you want to ask a question, you go right over here. She's got tickets for you. I will call out two numbers, and the person to ask a question and the person that will be next can ask the question. So I'll call out two numbers at a time. And when your number is called, please raise your hand or stand up, and a staff person with a microphone will come over. They'll check your number, and then you can ask your question. So when the senator is finished answering, I'll call the next two numbers, and in the interest of time, please keep your questions concise so the senator can engage with as many people as possible. We've got a lot of people here. Now, before Senator Wyden comes up, it is my sincere pleasure to introduce the hardest working state senator, not just in Oregon, I would say countywide, countrywide, that is. No one represents their constituents with more vigor, more wisdom, and with more results. We are so fortunate to have her leadership in District 16 and in the state legislature. Ladies and gentlemen, my state senator, Betsy Johnson.
Thank you. I'd like to acknowledge my legislative colleague, Representative Tiffany Mitchell. I think the senator is going to be acknowledged. But Representative Mitchell and I have the high honor of representing Clatsop County together, and thank you for being here. I have the easiest job of anybody today. Everybody knows Senator Wyden. In addition to serving on some of the most influential, important, and powerful committees in the Senate, Budget, Finance, Intelligence, Natural Resources. He is a steadfast defender of what he himself refers to as the Oregon way. And by that I mean taking care of constituents, hunting for compromise and the win-win, fighting like hell when you have to on certain big issues, and listening to Oregonians so that he can represent our interests in Congress. And that's what he's doing today for the 957th time. 957th. So I am honored to present our senator and my good friend, Ron Wyden.
Oh, Betsy, thank you. Thank you. Happy New Year to everyone. I appreciate those inflationary introductions. How many of you have never been to one of our town meetings? Raise your hand. pick out some newcomers. So you all know I do give long speeches to start it. It's a lot of fun. A gentleman there thinks I'm serious. Face, uh-oh, what am I getting into? No, this is not what today's about. This is about a pledge I made to Oregon. We were choosing our first new senator in more than 30 years. I said, if I have the honor to be chosen, I'll throw open the doors of government, and I'll have an open meeting in every county every year. So today, we're going to do it the way the founding fathers wanted us to do it. You're going to educate me. I'm going to listen. I have no prepared speeches. I have no teleprompters. Nothing that isn't going to be driven from the grassroots up. I'm just going to make one quick point because I'm so appreciative of having Betsy and Mark. And by the way, we've just got a who's who. We've got Port of Astoria Commissioner Frank Spence. I'm going to just let have all these nice people stand up. And Scott McLean and the City Council, Jesmyn West, Tom Brownson, Roger Rocca. Can all of you stand? Tiffany Mitchell still hasn't stood. Where is Tiffany? There is. Montero, the City Council. You know, if you're on the City Council, you get paid really big bucks. The drivers, chauffeurs, all that. We so appreciate them. And also from the County Commission, we have Leanne and Pam. Where are they? Let's have them stand up. Great. And the reason I wanted to recognize them is I want everybody to understand that right at the heart of what Betsy calls the Oregon Way, and it is something that you'll hear me talk a lot about. You know, a fella came up to me at Fred Meyer not too long ago and said, Ron, so I just keep hearing you talk about the Oregon Way. Like, is this written down somewhere? Is it like in the Capitol in Salem or in Pioneer Square? I want to go read the Oregon Way. If you're going to talk about it, I want to read the Oregon Way. So I tried to say, you know, it's not like that. It's not like some document written down. But we've had some wonderful people practice it over the years. Mark Hatfield, Tom McCall. They were Republicans. One of my favorites, in addition to Betsy and Tiffany and all these wonderful people, was the late Vera Katz. Vera Katz, the mayor of Portland, she was plenty liberal. And yet Betsy and everybody can tell you, folks in rural Oregon loved Vera Katz. Not only because she was the best at a watermelon spitting contest and beat Frank the Trans Harkin Rider, but because she always said, hey, let's find a way to get together. And a big part of the Oregon Way is on all of the big issues, federal and state and local, have to come together, whether it's healthcare, whether it's transportation, whether it's housing. You've got to have a coalition. You can't just say, well, it's all going to be the feds or it's all going to be one level of government, you know, after another. And frankly, a big part of this is even trying to articulate to people which level of government actually does it. So that's why we've gotten together 957 times, and as long as I have the honor to represent you, a first-generation Jewish kid who never, ever dreamed of such a thing, this is the way we'll do it. Mark, on with the show. You, Betsy, however you're going to do this.
Okay. Go ahead and read the last three numbers on the ticket. These have been well mixed, so. 417 and 397. All right, 417.
Mr. White, I'd like to thank you first.
He'll come with the mic there. Just...
Oh, Senator White, and I just want to thank you for your years of dedicated service, and also, how difficult is it to bring the Oregon Way to Washington, D.C.?
They don't, on a daily basis, seem to get the message. But we're trying to bring it, and what we do is, you know, we look for issues that can find, you know, common ground. I mean, that's what we have always tried to do. For example, we're going to have to find common ground on lowering the cost of prescription drugs in this next Congress. I've been able to do that in the Senate, okay? Chuck Grassley, he's the Republican chairman of the committee. And at one point, people were so surprised, Rhea Cantwell from Washington said, "That's a pretty big day. You got a Republican corn farmer from Iowa, Chuck Grassley, and a Democratic great panther from Oregon saying they're going to work together to stop pharmaceutical price gouging." So we've shown we can do it in the Senate. The House hadn't been able to do it. But we've got all these big issues coming at us. Trade and healthcare and infrastructure and schools and homelessness. So I'm not going to tell you that it isn't a challenge. And I think you all have been watching the debates about impeachment. I hope that we're going to get an agreement here between Senator Schumer and Senator McConnell soon. And I'll just kind of sum it up. I want a just outcome, not a political outcome. I want everybody in America to be able to say, look, I've got my views and I'm going to share mine. For example, I think it's very important to have these witnesses. We can talk about why and back and forth and the like. But the most important thing is that we have a just outcome, not a political outcome, and people say, this is the way we do it in America, and by the way we do it in Oregon.
All right, 397 and 394, you're next.
My big issue is the healthcare issue. My husband is disabled and doesn't get stuck with his disability. So at this point I have two. A couple months ago I had three. Besides having, I'm a teacher, so I have pretty good health insurance. But these three medical credit cards that I'm paying on with interest and all that, and if I'm in that position, I can't imagine what it's like for, you know, a family that has kids that, you know, get sick a lot more than I do. So that's a really huge issue for me, and how can we move forward with this? I mean, we had something started, now it's been thrown back, and where can we go?
Great question, and we could spend the afternoon on this, and this is the issue that's in my heart. I was director of the Great Panthers for about 7 years before I was elected to Congress. I had a full head of hair and rugged good looks. And I decided then that healthcare was far and away the most important issue. I mean, healthcare is up here, everything else is down here. And that's not to say they're unimportant. They're not important as well. But if you and your loved ones don't have your health, everything else falls apart. And you're sort of the face of this jerry-built system where in the Affordable Care Act, what we did, and I'm so glad that we took some positive steps, like ending discrimination against those with a pre-existing condition, because what that meant is healthcare was just before that, healthcare was for the healthy and wealthy. But we just kept adding on to this structure that was invented in the 40s when we really didn't have time to think it through. We had wage and price controls. So now we're sitting here spending $3.5 trillion a year on healthcare. There's 325 million of us. Divide 325 million into 3.5 trillion. You could send every family a for in America a check for $40,000 and say, get your health care. That would probably be pretty useful in getting rid of your, you know, credit card, you know, bills. So the question is, where do we go, you know, from here? My own judgment is the single most important thing now is holding down the costs. The Affordable Care Act expanded care, but it didn't do anywhere near enough to hold down the costs. And so starting with prescription, you know, drug prices, but hospitals, keeping people out of them, insurance companies, and stopping all the ways that they still find a way to get out of legal requirements. We're supposed to have parity, for example, between physical health and mental health. I meet a lot of people who say there's no parity between mental health and physical health. So at the top of my list is cost containment. We can talk some more about that. Personally, if you wanted me to sum up all these bills that are on offer, because there's a bill from Senator Sanders, there's various bills for a public option, which I have voted for and strongly support. I think we need more Medicare-type choices, because Medicare-type choices can introduce the competition that can hold the costs down. So we'll talk some more in the course of the afternoon, and I also believe that people ought to be able to discharge medical debts as well. I think that's a big source of bankruptcy and problems. They ought to be able to discharge them and deal with those costs. And for those who have individual situations, and I mean, just think about that. Here you are, we're starting a new year, and you just heard from one of your friends and neighbors who's up to their eyeballs in the richest, strongest country on earth, and she's paying for her health care by maxing out her credit cards. Shouldn't she at least have the kind of coverage her member of Congress gets?
Yeah.
I introduced a bill to do that. Had seven Democrats, seven Republicans. People debated it, and some liked it, some didn't like it. But I'm telling you, members of Congress aren't walking around with their credit cards maxed up in terms of health care coverage. So let's see where our staff folks are. Grace and Fritz and Tim are here. If you can just get a number. First thing I want to do is see if we can get you out from under that wrecking ball that's about to run over you with credit card debt. Okay? All right.
Okay, 394. And next will be 420.
Dr. Erickson from Seaside, Oregon, on behalf of Healthcare for All Oregon, Physicians for National Health Program, and that is how doctor is speaking to you once again at a town hall, as we have before. A year ago, at a town hall like this, you were asked, would you support Bernie Sanders' Medicare for All bill? You asked the audience on several points if they agreed with you that things needed to be done like that. But you had a point of disagreement. The disagreement was that you didn't like the idea of getting rid of private health insurance because you thought that people on Medicare that hadn't really liked their insurers and you didn't want to disrupt that. Since then, 12 months have gone by. We've had 35,000 preventable deaths, 530,000 medical bill-related bankruptcies. Again, I've been talking on this subject for 9 years, and you multiply those numbers out, and it's quite a big figure. I invite you to reconsider. I think half measures that have been proposed that sort of sound like reformation are not enough. The time for half measures on this is gone, and it's time we have you join us and try to get to single payer, universal coverage, privately delivered, publicly financed, improved Medicare for all. Can you do that today?
Let's keep walking through healthcare, because I want to talk about all the bills and Senator Sanders' bill. In particular, and I work often with Senator Sanders. In fact, he's been on the campaign road a little bit, as you've seen, and when in the budget committee there was a threat that the rules would be changed so that after the far right passed their big tax cuts, they would be able to easily cut domestic programs like Medicare and Medicaid, Senator Sanders said, I'd like Ron to handle that hearing. So it doesn't happen, and he was able to stay on the campaign trail, and I'm happy to do it for him. here's where we are, because you're right, a lot of time has gone by and a lot of things have changed. And let me kind of walk you through it and kind of my thinking now. First of all, no one knows how the election would come out. But if the Democrats take the United States Senate back, I would be the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee. And that's a committee with jurisdiction over $2 trillion worth of healthcare spending, Medicare, Medicaid, the state exchanges, CHIP, variety of different programs. And I've got, at least four, maybe five colleagues on the committee who certainly would call themselves progressive Democrats, who have their own approaches other than Senator Sanders' bill. For example, I sit right next to Senator Stabenow. And Senator Stabenow is a very good, strong, progressive voice. What she wants is to reform Medicare to make it available to people 50 and up. That is her preference. A little ways down the road, there is Senator Brown of Ohio, who wants, again, to lower the age. But Senator Brown makes a very important point, which is on display in New Hampshire, I believe, this morning on the basis of the articles I've read, and that is a big chunk of American labor is opposed to single payer. And in fact, in New Hampshire, it was described this morning that they're all up there because Iowa and New Hampshire and the labor people were not, you know, going to be part of any kind of single payer program. So that's Senator Brown. And then a few more seats away from Senator Brown, I've had Senator Stabenow and I've had Senator Brown, is Senator Michael Bennett, who has arguably the most expansive public option approach. Now, if I'm chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, I'm going to have to find a way to get common ground with all of these legislators who I think, by and large, would share your view on an awful lot, you know, of issues. I will tell you exactly where I stand, because much like I did when I made a pledge to have these open meetings in every county every year, nobody had ever done that. In the state's political history, no statewide official had ever said, I'm going to be open in every county every year. I want everybody to know another pledge I made, and that is, I won't quit until healthcare is a basic human right in this country. Period. Full stop. We just talked about with that, I might have lost her. Maybe she's working with the staff in the back. As we just heard from the previous speaker, maxed out in the richest country on earth on 3 credit cards because of crushing medical debts. How can that be? So I want you to know I'm going to work very closely with you. I'm going to work very closely with Senator Sanders. And by the way, there's been discussion in the past, you know, health, Medicare for all, single payer hadn't been at the table. I'll tell you, if I'm chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, that will not be the case. Everybody will be at the table. Certainly, certainly, people who've been excluded in the past have got to, you know, be there, because this is the most important issue. And frankly, you look around the world in places that spend less on prescription drugs and people live longer and they are in better health. We can do much better than this. Gesundheit over there, we've already got colds breaking out when we're talking about it. So we'll put this in to be continued, and my staff has had a number of meetings with Medicare for All folks, and we'll keep doing it.
420. And next will be 388.
Hello there, Senator White. Thank you very much for giving me this opportunity. I'm trying to talk about climate change, and I have a solution to whisper in your ear.
I want you to boom it out to everybody. We don't like those, you know, secrets being passed that the public doesn't hear about.
Well, no. What it is I think that we could establish what I call a solar bank. in which, like everybody in Oregon, would have 10 kilowatts of solar power in their name that they would pay off over the with their electric bill, kind of. And pretty soon we'd be an electric juggernaut and could go a long ways to giving us a theory on how to get through this, because that's what I think is lacking, is there's no solution. I'll just take that.
Well, and obviously climate change is enormously important. My wife and I are older parents, and we have twins that are 12 and a little one that is 7, brightest red hair on the planet. And pictures are available on my iPhone after the meeting, anyone who wants to see them. Betsy and Tiffany have been through the legislative session and all that accompanied it, and the back and forth, and the Senate wasn't in, and I didn't get to follow all of it, but one of the things that I was struck by is it seemed that a number of the people and folks in, you know, rural Oregon, and we have all our town meetings out there, and important industries for us, forest products and trade and manufacturing and others, seem to be making the case that Oregon was going to take a position that might in some way put us in a disadvantageous way with other states. I mean, I just kind of listened to the whole thing. So I want you to know, given that I heard those voices in the Oregon debate, I'm interested in taking a different approach, and let me give you the centerpiece. Right now, there are 44 separate tax breaks for energy in the federal tax code. It comes to billions and billions of dollars. Billions, not millions, billions. If I'm chairman of the Finance Committee, the first thing I'm going to try to do, and I will do it, I've got to get it passed, is I'll take those 44 and I'll dump them in the garbage can. Okay? Very first thing. Because most of them are just kind of relics to yesteryear. They're all the big money ones are geared towards the fossil fuel thing. And of course, because Texas and Louisiana, anybody whose last name was Long, seem to get a bunch of tax breaks. And what I'm going to propose is throwing them all in the garbage can, all 44, and substituting for the 44 three, one for clean energy, one for clean transportation fuel, and one for energy efficiency. And I've been out talking to my Republican colleagues, and I've been saying, folks, you want a more efficient market, and you want less subsidies. That's what I'm proposing, a more efficient market and fewer subsidies. And you bet, when I'm home at these town meetings, I hope Betsy and Mark and Chris will still come with me, I'm gonna say we can get more green for less green. We can have more green energy at less cost to taxpayers. Now, there are a lot of other pieces to the puzzle, but because of the role of the Finance Committee, that's where I'm going to start, and I'd be happy if you can give us more information on yours to look at it. That's serious.
Well, I really appreciate that. I think some of the benefits that don't get seen is a decentralization, and the fact that everybody is kind of comfortable being tied in a knot about it, and we have to really break through in a big way right away.
This clearly, I mean, in a lot of ways, when people say, well, we've got to get this done, in a lot of ways, you see the damage that has already been done. And we know about it as well in the West with these fires. These are not our grandfather's fires. They are bigger and hotter, and there are a lot of reasons for them. We've got this huge backlog where we haven't done enough to go in and clean out the dead and dying material. And Senator Mike Crapo and I, the Republican senator from Idaho, have gotten a bill passed to expedite that. But I think it is also hotter and drier because of climate change. So this is not something that you can just say is another garden variety bill and hope we'll get to it some session or some day and have a hearing and then everybody can go have lunch. This is really urgent business. Well said.
388. And next will be 390.
Hi, Senator Wyden. Thank you for being here. My name is Lori Beth Culp. I own Laura's Tours, and I have a little tour company. And despite the ethics violations against our marketing director at the port, he's still operating his business as usual. And I would just like to know, who has jurisdiction over our Port of Astoria? Our tour operators are not able to get a fair and decent contract to work with the cruise lines. And I lost 4 major cruise line businesses because of the actions of the port, and nobody seems to be doing anything about that.
Let me bring my state and local colleagues in. Where is the line accountability for decisions? I was under the assumption that it was state and local, but if there is a federal way in which you can get the kind of accountability that everybody in this room deserves, I'm in. Betsy, what?
We've worked on this hard. I'm well aware of the case. We've talked on the phone. The accountability for the port is at the ballot box. Those are publicly elected port commissioners, and they govern the port.
By everyone in the county, Clatsop County?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
So that's the principal place. This is a case I'm very familiar with, and Lori, if you want to call me, we'll take another shot at it.
Betsy, does that mean, apropos of the fact that the county is in control, there are county rules or ordinances?
Ports are a special district.
Ports are a special district.
So they're governed by their board of commissioners that are elected by the people.
Got it. All right, let's do this. I think I see the speaker back there, and this is a hugely important issue, and I will tell you that when we get to infrastructure, roads and bridges and transportation systems, I'm going to make sure that ports are a part of that infrastructure. If I had my way, they would have been the first bill in 2017 and not something that's an afterthought after you've spent all this money maintaining tax breaks for multinationals and, in fact, actually making them bigger. So let me figure out what are the rules for special districts and the county. I'll work with Betsy and your local officials here. I don't want people coming and thinking that I'm in charge of something when the federal government isn't. Is that fair?
It is fair. I would like to see the marketing director position held by somebody that has no ties to any local business in the community. It should be held by an outsider so everyone would get a fair and level playing field. That's really what me and other tour operators are looking for, and we're not getting
it. Has there been any kind of investigation? I mean, it sounds like Betsy is clearly trying to be helpful. Has there been anything to look at? I mean, there is a state ethics group. They probably don't have authority over this.
This has been through the state ethics.
Oh.
And there was a finding of fault. It's a complicated situation.
All right, we're gonna follow it up with you, and I've learned more about state and local ethics in the last 10 minutes than I have known in my lifetime. So thank you for that input. There's a wonderful story about how people can't sort out government, and it's heard often in Washington where a woman calls her senator, big deal, he's very powerful, she calls him and calls him. He comes out of the meeting and he says, Mrs. Jones, let's call her, you've been calling and calling me. And she said, Mr. Senator, I've got a big problem. I haven't been able to get my garbage picked up for 3 straight days. And the senator said, Mrs. Jones, that is a really serious thing. I wouldn't want that to happen to me, and I want to help. How about we start
by having you call the people up at the city sanitation department and asking them to come pick up the garbage. And she said, Mr. Senator, great idea. But I never thought I'd have to go up that high. And, you know, the point is, when folks have concerns, they just want them resolved. So we're going to stay on it on this ports issue. And for all of you port officials, I want you to know that when we get to this infrastructure issue, and if I had my way, it would have been a long time ago, I'm going to make sure that ports are part of that infrastructure, you know, program, because you cannot have big league economic growth with little league services at ports. You just can't do it, okay?
All right, 390. And next is 396.
I realize this question is probably going to get kicked over here. It has to do with housing and homelessness. At the beginning, you mentioned your cats and homelessness. Kind of just work, but I was homeless in Portland when Vera Katz was mayor. She wasn't good for it. Just to the people who have housing, great. She was fantastic. She did a lot of good stuff. But for those of us who were actually dealing with that particular issue, she was terrible. My question, though, has more to do with right now. And across the country, there's a lack of affordable housing. In Clatsop County, that's no different. I know that we have a serious shortage of anything even resembling affordable housing here. I was looking last night, a two-bedroom apartment is well over $1,000. We don't have wages in this county to support that kind of a rent. What can you do?
Yeah. Let me tell you what I just outlined for Oregonians about a week or so ago. We have something called the Business Leadership Summit. It's in Portland. People come from all 36 counties, and I'm not going to buck this question to Betsy or Tiffany or Mark or anybody, because I think there's a very substantial federal role, and I want to describe for you what I said to folks in every county in the state here like a week or so ago. I'm going to introduce federal legislation, whether I'm chairman or not, called the DASH Act, the Decent, Affordable, Safe Housing for All Act, okay? And what we're gonna do is every 2 years, the federal government, and I would start funding it by taking some of the tax breaks for folks at the top who didn't need them, take some of those tax breaks and give those dollars to the state housing department and give them to them with one goal that would essentially be measured every 2 years. And in the first 2 years of the enactment of this law, what I told people across the state a week ago, I will tell you, I want this country to use that money that would, this bill would go to the Finance Committee, and you take some of the tax breaks for folks at the top, and you'd set an objective, working with your colleagues in the states for every 2 years, and for the first 2 years of the DASH Act, I want that money used to put a roof over every homeless child in America, period, full stop. That would be the very first objective. And then we'd start from there filling in the gaps. But you gotta get started somewhere, and you've gotta say that you've got an agenda for homelessness. And you talk about what you're seeing here. There's not a nook and cranny in the state. I go to, you know, to meetings. I went to Wagon Tire, you know, recently, and the sign says Population 3. And I went looking for folks, and everybody said they were at lunch. So there are probably some places where I haven't seen everybody. But I can tell you that this is not just a metro area issue. So it is one where there are responsibilities at federal and state and local, you know, levels. We've been able to get some additional help in this budget that just passed, what's called Section 8 housing. Senator Merkley and I are teaming up on it. But this is going to take some additional money used in a way that produces some accountability. I mean, we just had a question where somebody was at a port, it went through the state and their ethics, and you've still got, you know, the head of your, you know, port still asking questions or port operators. So I don't want you to say I'm bucking the ball to somebody else. I'm going to introduce that legislation. I told you how I would propose paying for it. I said there'd be accountability, and every 2 years, the Congress on a bipartisan basis would make a judgment about it. You know why I picked the children? Not only because I think there's a choice in America where you either deal with these issues early on, but the state housing director recently told me that not very long ago, the state was running buses, the government, local governments were running buses to go by the parks to pick up children for the school day. In other words, those kids had been sleeping outside, and the government had to have buses go to parks to pick kids up. And just ask yourself, how's a kid gonna learn if they've been outside all night in this cold, in this kind of rain? So that's how I picked it. And that's what I'm doing, that's what I've announced, and you and everybody else can hold me accountable.
As a follow-up, is there anything you're doing to combat the current moves by the administration regime and their moves that are appearing to look like criminalizing homelessness?
Yeah. That's why I mentioned in the budget what we have done on a bipartisan basis has picked up support for throwing a lot of these cruel policies aside. Democrats and Republicans both have said, and look, what we know is if kids or folks who would like to get on their feet and be able to find jobs, they're not gonna be in a position to do it if they don't have a roof over their head and ability to get, you know, a decent diet. So yes, in that budget, we were able to restore a number of the cuts that came from Trump. And the reason I sat on the budget committee, and the doctor, I guess, asked me about Senator Sanders, and he asked me to step in and help him with the tax thing, is because that's the first stop where a lot of this budget meanness goes, and I wanted to work with Democrats and Republicans to stop it.
All right, next is 396, and after that is 411. 396? All right, how about 411?
And don't be shy. The other day at one of the high schools, all the students were being very shy, and I could hear one of them say to the other, they said, "This dude up there looks so serious. Do you think he'll come to our house and ask questions?" No, we're just kind of doing it the Oregon way. So everybody just say what's on their mind.
Okay, 385. We have 385. And next will be 410.
Mike Spence, Port of Astoria Commissioner. Rebuttal time. First, I appreciate your statements about funding ports. We have already been designated by FEMA to be the primary location for help and assistance after the Cascadia event. Our port and airport are on the west side of the Medford Bridge. It's estimated that all the bridges will be down, and our connecting routes of Route 30 and 26 will be cut off. So the primary location for assistance in the future will be our port. We need assistance. Senator Betsy Johnson has been very helpful in the past of providing funds. We have a deteriorating facility, and our infrastructure needs help to reinforce our existing piers as well as our marina. And assistance, we've looked at the Federal Maritime Administration and certainly FEMA, but our assistance up to date really has come from the state, and any assistance that the federal government can make would be appreciated.
Let's do this. Senator Merkley and I work together on these issues. You get us the information, we will dig into it right away. I mean, we cannot have small communities on the Oregon coast, in effect, because of federal neglect, become sacrifice zones where people just say, hey, that's the way it goes. We don't have the money for the rural hospital. We don't have the money for the port. We don't have the money for broadband. And that isn't going to happen on my watch. This county is particularly challenged because the Secure Rural Schools bill that I wrote, you know, years ago goes to counties where their federal forests haven't been, aren't federal forests. In this county in that same way. So I'll definitely go to work with you and we'll see what we can do. And Senator Merkley's on the Appropriations Committee, I'm on the Finance Committee, and we put together our agendas together to try to advance these Oregon priorities and the Oregon coast to sure one of them. All right. Yeah, sure, go ahead.
As a PS, though, bring you up to date on the economic impact of the Port of Astoria. First, we're the only port on the whole coast of Oregon that does handle cruise ships. And this individual that's our marketing director, who has been working for the port for 20 years, has proven his value in that next year, this year, 2020, we will be hosting a record number of 33 cruise ships to this port, this county, this state. And the economic impact of the revenue that they generate is in the millions of dollars, between $8 to $20 million a year. So we're very proud of what we're doing, and we're going to continue to do it even better.
So you're for the gentleman that the person in the back had questions about, if I can sum it up.
Yes.
Got it. Okay. Let me factor that in as I talk to Betsy and, you know, all of you, and of course, this is something that probably no one wants a United States Senator jumping in the middle of. My wife often says, you've already got your hands full. At one point they asked her at some kind of function what committee I was on, and before I could say anything, she said, if my husband had his way, he'd be on every committee. So let us work with Betsy and Tiffany and all of the local officials, and we'll be glad to follow up with you. Okay.
All right, did we have 410? And next will be 392.
Thank you, Senator. My question regards the whistleblower and that statute. And I apologize, I haven't read the statute, so I'm asking you. I had thought that the whistleblower was afforded privacy and would not, his identity wouldn't be revealed, so that would cause that would allow other people to come forward. And I'm just wondering now that there seems to be an effort to divulge this man's identity, or this person's identity, is someone who's suggesting that or trying to do that, or in fact doing it, are they breaking the law?
Well, you're being logical. And heaven should break out over some of what goes on in Washington, D.C. I'm co-chair of the Whistleblower Caucus with Senator Grassley. We work in a bipartisan way. And the law clearly speaks to the question of retaliation against a whistleblower. All right? The whistleblower in this case certainly feels that they have been retaliated against They've been quoted about all the threats and all the things that they've had to do in order to protect themselves. So the law definitely speaks to the proposition you cannot retaliate against a whistleblower. And certainly in this case, again, I'm on the Intelligence Committee. My older child calls it the so-called Intelligence Committee. But I can't get into classified matters. Certainly in the news media, the person identified as a whistleblower believes they've been retaliated against. The law is clear, you cannot retaliate against whistleblowers. Now, interesting development. You may have seen that the Inspector General did a report on the whole question of the investigation into Donald Trump, and there were questions about whistleblowers there, and a number of my colleagues said, my God, the rights of whistleblowers have been broken. This was in a case that they care a lot about. So the news media came to me and said, Ron, you've been working on bipartisan reform of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act for a long time. Have your Republican colleagues gotten religion? Are they going to work with you? And I said, well, hope springs eternal. And I'm certainly happy to have some newfound lovers of strong privacy rights. And I hope that now, as a result of the fact that people see that these abuses cut both ways. You know, it comes back again to this kind of Oregon, you know, approach. We were talking about whistleblower law in Oregon. I think Democrats and Republicans would say you apply the principles the same to both sides. And too often that has not been the case in Washington, D.C., and I just gave you an example of one instance where you have the person who spoke out and detailed at great length about the Ukraine situation. And then you have another where the Inspector General made comments about something that the president cared a whole lot about. So my sense is what we ought to do is go in there and tighten up the whistleblower laws and make it clear that retaliation means, for example, putting somebody's name in the newspaper, number one. It also means that if we have these apps tracking people with location devices, that can be subject to rules and oversight. So there's a lot to be done here.
Yeah, I can ask that.
Sure.
Quick question. So is there, as it stands now, is there a penalty for revealing this person's name?
It's not clear. There are penalties for retaliation. I believe that what happened to this person, whose name's been in the newspaper, and he's talked about all the things he's had to do to try to protect himself, that breaks the law. That retaliation broke the law. That's my opinion.
All right, 392. 392, so 395. And next will be 384.
Thank you, Senator. I'm concerned about climate change, and I'm concerned about the role of forestry in climate change, and also the power of large corporations. And that, to me, is vital. I know as long as they have the same right of speech that an individual has, it's somewhat difficult. But we have large corporations in Oregon, up and down the coast, who are using the harshest methods of logging, and as a result, that is the largest, that those logging practices are the largest contributor of greenhouse gases in this state. They even surpass transportation. So my question is, how are we ever going to rein in these corporations?
Two areas. I mentioned what I'm going to do with respect to the tax benefits that these companies get. And if you want to see a stunning description of this deeply flawed Trump tax law, there is a long analysis in the national press that describes how the special interests, these multinational corporations, did incredibly well in the 2017 tax bill, which I led the opposition to, where the government borrowed $1.5 trillion that could have gone to ports and roads and what Betsy and Tiffany are working on with the federal state, you know, partnership. And the stories that have come out in the last day or two is that that wasn't enough for the big multinational companies. They went after all of the people at the Treasury Department and they added billions of dollars worth of breaks that wasn't even in the bill. It's kind of like you went to the all you can eat and you stuffed yourself. And then after a while, you said, let's go have some more. Party goes on. So, I mentioned what I was going to do with their tax breaks, okay? But here's what this is all about. And there's no way to sugarcoat it. This is about the United States Supreme Court decision known as Citizens United. I believe it's one of the worst decisions our court has ever made. And I want to make sure everybody knows why I say that. This court has basically said that a rich guy's checkbook is pretty much the same thing as the poor person standing out in front of Fred Meyer on a rainy day, because we just stopped at Fred Meyer, on a rainy day, and shouting at the top of your lungs. According to this Supreme Court, both of those acts, the writing out the checks by the people who are most well off and the person out in front of Fred Meyer, are exactly the same thing to this Supreme Court. Exactly the same thing. Their speech and they're protected in exactly the same way. I will tell you, and I'm not making a personal comment about a justice, I'm talking policy here. I think to say that a rich person's check is the same as somebody outside in the rain in Astoria speaking, trying to be heard that way, is an absurd comparison. Because we know that that rich person's checkbook buys an enormous amount of content. And that person shouting to the world from the door of Fred Meyer is not going to reach anywhere near as many people. So I strongly support overturning Citizens United. I've supported it with my votes. I've supported it with all kinds of grassroots movements. I think it is very much behind a lot of what people are talking about here, number one. And one of the reasons that we're here for town hall meeting number 957 is I know how angry people are about government now, and how there's a sense that it's rigged and nobody cares about what they have to say. The only way you get heard is to write out checks. So that's why we're having these town hall meetings, so that people understand that there's a way to hold folks accountable. And I really want to praise Betsy and Tiffany and all of your other local elected officials, because they didn't have to be here today. Wasn't their town meeting, but they came too because they wanted to hear what you had to say and didn't just say, well, this is about lobbying.
Next will be 421.
A different vein altogether. On the 1st of April, we're really having the census. I wasn't counted 10 years ago, and I probably won't be counted this year because I'm going to be outside the country. What can be done to fill out a paper form?
Well, number one, if you're out of the country and we can work with you, unless I'm missing something, there are specific provisions for dealing with someone who's outside the country. Grace Stratton is here from our office, and we can work with you on that. So I think that's number one, and I was quite certain that that was the case, and Grace was busy nodding at me. So I feel that she is, our staff person is doing a good job on the consent on the census. I will tell you also that we know that this administration, and particularly Wilbur Ross of this administration, have been willing to cut corners on the census and tried to find ways in which they could, you know, put information on the census to try to force everybody to disclose where they were from and this sort of thing, and the courts have blocked them. So our state, and Tiffany and Betsy probably have more information on this, also has a committee that is working very hard with churches and community programs and others to make sure we get the word out. But apropos of your point, sir, Grace will come back and visit with you, but I know there are provisions for making sure someone can be counted. You do not have to be anchored to a specific spot on a specific day to be counted.
All right, 421. Next will be 386.
Hello, Senator White. Thank you for being here today. I wanted to speak in favor of the Democratic caucus's efforts to insist on a fair impeachment trial in the Senate. And I wanted to say that there should be witnesses and there should be subpoenas issued to compel both the documents and the witnesses. And I wanted to say that any witnesses that fail to appear should be held in inherent contempt of Congress and that they should be arrested.
So, I think I made it clear how strongly I feel about demonstrating their fairness and due process and a fair trial. And I will just tell you, you listen to the comments of the Senate Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell, and he just seems very reluctant, almost afraid to accept that. Now, I don't know what his reluctance is all about. I've read the speculation that, you know, he's afraid of Trump supporters and that he's afraid of their reaction. My accountability is to all of you. And I just want everybody to know that A, I hope Senator Schumer and Senator McConnell reach an agreement. Senator McConnell, I think, is going to speak on the Senate floor tomorrow, and then we'll all be back beginning of next week, and that's when I think the discussions will start. I hope that the two can reach an agreement. I think that's the key here. But I don't understand how you can do this without witnesses. I mean, you see the testimony that was given about John Bolton's remarks. And John Bolton, as has been alleged, was saying he didn't want anything to do with this cutting the Ukraine off aid and described it as like a drug deal. So there are important issues. And I think to not have the relevant witnesses, and particularly John Bolton and Mick Mulvaney and their assistants, makes it very hard to do that. And people have said, well, that's not the way it was done in the Clinton impeachment. When the Clinton impeachment, nobody failed to hand over documents or to appear. That was just factually wrong. I mean, I read that, and I read it from several places. Well, we're going to do it like the Clinton impeachment. Bill Clinton, for whatever you thought of him, did not hold back on documents or witnesses. So it's very important that this be clearly fair, shows due process, and people are going to get tired of me hearing me say it. But I'm going to keep coming back to just outcome, not political outcome, just outcome. That's at a time in our lives, certainly unlike any other time in my life, I think the American people deserve that and nothing less. Sure.
Is there any way that the doctrine of inherent contempt can be used to force witnesses to show up when they're subpoenaed so they cannot ignore subpoenas?
I'm a lawyer in name only. I ran the legal aid office for the elderly, and my wife said she would marry me because when she heard about it, she said, you're not a real lawyer. And those real lawyers have driven all those business people crazy and all this kind of thing. So there's a lot of debate about exactly what you're talking about, and I'm certainly going to keep Oregon apprised over it. But I don't think there's been any resolution of that. People all said, well, what are you going to expect? And there was this great historical analysis that said the only thing you can expect in an impeachment trial is the unexpected. And I think certainly your question is one of the issues that's important, that if you have witnesses, what are the responsibilities to actually appear?
All right, 386. And next will be 400.
Thanks for coming to our story, Senator. Recently I was driving to Portland on the day that Dr. Hill and your fellow testified in the House, not so much of a stir, this kind of context. Later on, I tuned into Fox News to see what they said about it, and, you know, it wasn't the same story. And what I'm concerned about is your position on the Intelligence Committee and whether this could have anything to do with foreign interference in our politics in general. I think that Dr. Hill made a good point that Russia would like to divide us against ourselves. And I don't think they have to try very hard to do that. But who can we believe? Where can we tune in to see the real story?
Well, first, so that you hear the real story, at least from one member of the Intelligence Committee, as of today, unless we're allowed to bring up on the floor of the Senate the election security legislation, which I'm largely the author of, what passed the House, it would require hand-marked paper ballots. It would require risk-limiting audits. And here's a really radical provision. You wouldn't be able to leave a voting machine with an open connection to the internet. Having a voting machine with an open connection to the internet is pretty much the equivalent of handing your ballots over to the Kremlin. Okay? So we're trying to get this passed. I hope that we'll be able to do it. And I'm not going to say anything other than this. It will not just be the Russians. There will be plenty of hostile powers and hostile interests who will do everything they can to interfere in our election. No question in my mind. And those hostile interests and those hostile powers will make what happened in 2016 look like small potatoes. Okay? Now, as far as getting accurate information, I'll tell you the same thing I tell high school students. I try to go everywhere you can. I have a kind of rule that if I have a chance to be near a TV, I'll watch 20 minutes of Fox and I'll watch 20 minutes of MSNBC. And then I'll have gotten a sense of what kind of part of the American electorate is saying. But you really need to try to read and talk to a variety of sources. And then ultimately, in a free country, we get a chance to make up our own mind. Okay. My favorite quote, I see people trying to look like they're going to wrap up, but my favorite quote is from an Israeli diplomat, Abe Ben, who said once, "The Americans always get it right." And he paused and he said, "After they've tried everything else." And I think there's a lot of truth to that. Okay.
400. Okay, we got two more questions after this. 401. And then the last question will be 414.
Thanks for coming to my little town. Highway 101 between here and Seaside, we'd get some federal money wide now. It's a dangerous road. We've all lost friends and people we know. As well as Highway 30. Real quick. Baseball in Oregon.
Did you say baseball?
Baseball in Oregon. If you could just Russell Wilson has got ahead of a group.
So, two good questions, and I'll wrap up with sports. I went to school on a basketball scholarship dreaming of playing in the NBA. It's a ridiculous idea, because I was too small and I made up for it by being really slow. So, I am supportive of making sure that we can have the kinds of athletics, the kinds of sports that Oregonians want. Questions are really about paying for it, particularly how you deal with the public aspect, the public funding. In Washington, D.C., they're trying to ladle out tax breaks for stadiums that are far removed from communities and things like that. I'm not going to support that as a senior guy on the finance committee. I do think that one of the things that you can look at is, as you talk about roads, often those kinds of roads can be good for communities and schools and the like, and also be helpful to businesses, sports included. So I think there's a way to go about that. I'll tell you, in 2017, the beginning of Donald Trump's term, Donald Trump invited Senator Hatch, who's then the chairman of the committee, and myself in, and I told him, "Mr. President, every member of the Finance Committee, every single Democrat, and every single Republican," because we had a special effort. Chairman Hatch asked me to do it. I said, "Absolutely." Every Democrat and every Republican said that a significant portion of the money in a tax bill that would be repatriated, in other words, the money coming back from overseas, every Democrat and every Republican said, "We want a significant portion of that devoted to infrastructure, roads and bridges and transportation systems." We had some differences of opinion about what percentage it should be and all that. But every Democrat, every Republican on the key committee that comes up with the money for roads and bridges, ports and transportation, said, "That's our priority. Bring it home, put it in to things that really benefit our communities." The president took it in, he said, "You've got a big point." He said, "That's what I did in New York. That's what I want to do as president." And he turned around and left infrastructure in the dust and borrowed $1.5 trillion for tax breaks for the most powerful people, and spent the rest of his first term trying to gut the Affordable Care Act, which, while far from perfect, what he wants to do is throw the protection for people with pre-existing conditions in the garbage can and go back to the days when healthcare is for the healthy and wealthy. So I want it understood that if I'm chairman of the Finance Committee, the first thing we'll try to do is go back to having a bipartisan approach on infrastructure and making it clear that borrowing $1.5 trillion and then using the money that comes home, even though you don't have fair rates for the multinational corporations, giving them more, as we've seen in the paper in the last couple of days, than the law allows, while starving Highway 101 that needs, you know, improvements, is not my idea of the priorities. I got a very different set of priorities, and so often, when I'm back there and I'm thinking about it, and I just look at the weather around the state, I'm trying to say to myself, I'm sure Betsy and Tiffany and all our elected officials do this, what's it like on a winter night when it's dark and gray and it's icy on the Oregon coast? What are the risks? What's the likelihood that this is going to be the night where there's going to be a tragedy that's going to strike some coastal family? So you got my attention, my friend. If I had my way, we would have done it. It's the first bill in 2017, and if I have my way in 2021, we'll be serious about it coming first. So, I'm sure you go home disagreeing with me about one subject or two subjects. I'm really appreciative of Mark and Betsy and Tiffany and all our great elected officials. I don't have all the answers, folks. Not by a long shot. I can cast a vote at 11 o'clock in the morning in Washington. My wife calls me at 12:30 and says, "You blew that one, Buster. A bad vote." But what I can tell you is January 2nd, these are some of the first town meetings, I think, in the United States, unless some other senator didn't have a team in a bowl game and wanted to start yesterday. This is the way the founding fathers wanted it to look. Not have Citizens United driving all the decisions, where the big money people are out playing golf with elected officials or candidates. They wanted it to look like this. And I just want you to know, big thanks to Mark, to Betsy, Tiffany, all of our elected officials. We got a whole, you know, flock of them. As long as I have the honor to represent you in the United States Senate, an honor I never, ever thought a first-generation Jewish kid, you know, would have. This is the way we'll do it. We'll do it at the grassroots. And we are now in the to be continued department. Thanks, everybody.